Because I'm an outsider, I look at it from my viewpoint, you're suffering so much, and you could do some other stuff to get closer to God. You could help an orphan or, I don't know, do some other things. Why do fasting?
Okay, my personal take on this is, like, you know, if you're talking about mustahab, the recommended fast, which are not obligatory, you know, for me, fasting makes me more mindful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, because, you know, fasting, if you really go inside the meaning of fasting, it's not just, you know, not eating food.
Exactly.
It's also, you know, stopping ourselves from sins. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, not eating or not drinking. It's also, you know, not committing sins with our eyes, with our mouth or with our hands. Or we just don't walk, to commit a sin. We have to stop all these things, right? You know, if you look at it from this perspective, you know, not eating food, like, you know, this is the physical side of it and the spiritual side of it. You know, you get more mindful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
It makes you more considerate.
Yeah, more considerate about, you know, it makes you like muttaqi, mindful of Allah. Like,
yes.
It makes you pious.
That's very true.
You could also say it, in a sense, it detaches you from this world.
Exactly.
In a sense where you're not so connected to this world because, again, you're preventing yourself because God, like, in a sense, you're doing this for God. And in a sense where, look, there's something more than just this physical body.
Mm-hmm.
There's something more than just this physical world. So by, in a sense, cutting yourself off from some aspects of this world,
mm-hmm.
you can transcend to a world higher than this world.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Just to make it clear for those who do not have any idea about fasting and things that we're talking about, it has been said that there is a happiness, two happiness for the people who fast. One is in Sahar and one is in Iftar. And both of these times are such a spiritual feelings in the person who have done the fasting, which makes it so precious that they take all the suffering throughout the day to get into these two moments, right? Mm-hmm. Am I right or not? It's the feeling of fasting is something that gives you some good vibes, as the modern people call it. If we do not,
yeah, there's
call
a sense
the
of fulfillment
reward.
In
yes,
those.
You feel like it has really had some good effects on you. Just the detachment you talked about.
Yeah,
it's not the
I
real
completely
world.
Agree with that. That there is a sense of fulfillment
mm-hmm.
at both times, in the sense where, look, you're making that intention that, look, now I'm going to try to, in a sense, detach myself from this world and focus on other things. The same thing that Brother Hassanain said. Look, when you're fasting, it's not just you're starving yourself. But in a sense, your outlook and your viewpoint of the world changes. It's not now, typically you would go and you're not really paying that much attention on a normal day compared to, suppose, a day that you're fasting, where you're more aware of what you're doing, what you're seeing,
exactly.
what you're listening to, what you're... I guess you're not eating in this sense, but
mm-hmm.
like what you're thinking about, what you're doing with your body as well, compared to normal days where for most people, it just goes right over their head,
mm-hmm.
where they don't really have a care about what's happening and what they're doing and in what
yes,
way they're doing
that's
it.
That's very true. Now, if somebody asks you, what will you gain of this fasting? What would you say?
Okay. What you will gain,
mm-hmm.
It's a two-sided answer because what people expect when you say what will you gain is like a physical gain from this. That look, oh, you do this and you get, suppose, like a monetary reward afterwards. But over here, fasting is, in a sense, is an action to elevate yourself, where the reward
exactly.
isn't more physical but more spiritual in a sense.
That is very true.
Getting oneself more closer to God. Right? Feeling that achievement of fulfillment towards the end of a fast and at the start of a fast is that closeness that you know you've taken a couple more steps closer to God than you did suppose the day before.
But if you maybe some audience would ask you, then you can say your prayers in order to get closer to God. What would you tell them?
The same thing applies to prayers.
Nah, the thing about prayers is, like, you know, the difference between fast and prayer is, like, you pray, you have to pray Salah, like, you have to pray Fajr Salah. Like, there's this two-unit prayer, right? Like, that takes hardly 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But fasting, it lasts, like, you know, from sunrise until the sunset.
You have to take care of yourself for more time.
Yeah, for more time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like more like, you know, you're praying Salah. Like for those few minutes, you're focused.
You're focused
and you're the guest of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
But like fasting is like, it's like almost half of the day.
It's that same focus, but it's just over a longer period of time.
Yes, that's very true.
And rewards, if you talk about, you know, the abundant rewards and...
So right now, we are in Back to Reality talking about fasting before the holy month, which is the obligation. Many people go for fasting in a voluntarily sense, and they do it in order to get closer to God. And the two very dear guests made it very much clear for us. Why they do it and what are going to be the rewards of fasting. So thank you for letting us know more about the feelings of a person who has been fasting. Thank you, Brother Jaffa. Though you were fasting, you helped us a lot. Yes, and pray for us, of course. Don't forget us.
I was saying that, you know, we shouldn't forget that we get good food as well.
Yes, yes, that's the reward. I hope that's not the only reward. So thank you for listening to us. This was Back to Reality. Until another session, from me and from the entire cast of Back to Reality, we bid you farewell. Thank you for listening.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
South Korea test launched a solid-fuel space rocket designed to place a satellite into low orbit for surveillance and reconnaissance of North Korea. The test comes just 1 week after North Korea tested a long-range ICBM, prompting a UN Security Council emergency meeting and more sanctions from the United States. Activists in South Korea argue that the behavior of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and its double standards cause tension.
Now, they say a lot about the missiles launched by North Korea, but nobody criticizes South Korea and the U.S. firing ICBMs and various other missiles. I think that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is getting worse because of such a hypocritical attitude.
The U.S. last year agreed to allow South Korea to develop missiles of unlimited range. President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol has said he will strengthen the country's alliance with the U.S. and the missiles Seoul deploys. Policies garnering significant support.
The ability to quickly receive various military and security information thanks to satellites will strengthen national defense. The stronger our national defense, the more it might provoke North Korea. But I think that the stronger our power, the more it can contribute to peace.
South Korea's president-elect also advocates the preparation of a preemptive missile attack on North Korea if Pyongyang poses an imminent threat. South Korea appears determined to develop space-based military applications in line with its alliance with the United States. South Korea's Air Force chief is scheduled to travel to the U.S. Space and Missile Command next week and discuss South Korea joining a multilateral space alliance led by Washington. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Partygate scandal lingers on, with the roll call of shame growing ever longer with every leak. On Tuesday, more bad news for Prime Minister Boris Johnson's inner circle as the identity of another high-profile COVID rule-breaker was revealed. Helen McNamara, ironically the government's former ethics chief, has apologized for her part in attending a party on June 18, 2020 in the Cabinet Office during the height of COVID restrictions, calling it an error in judgment. There has been criticism of the way the Partygate scandal continues to be addressed by the government and why the identities of those issued with fines has still not been made public.
It's fairly amazing. If either you or me had been fined for breaking lockdown, I'm sure our names would have been in the public domain, in the media, etc. Here we have very high-profile people indeed who have been fined and were not allowed supposed to know their names. Now, some names have leaked out. We know that Helen McNamara was incredibly in charge of ethics and propriety for Downing Street, and she has been fined. We know that Kate Josephs, who credibly was running the COVID task force at the time, had a leaving party. She went off to Sheffield City Council to get a new job. She was in charge of the COVID task force and was breaking the COVID lockdown restrictions.
With the next phase of the Sue Gray report expected to be published in May, there is mounting pressure for full disclosure to avoid further embarrassment.
Parliamentarians in the building behind me, many of them from the government's own benches, are growing tired of the constant drip-drip of leaks and names, with every week seemingly bringing fresh revelations. Whilst there have been pushes to have full transparency over Partygate, there has been some resistance from the very heart of government. Seemingly, some argue, so the public loses interest.
Despite the Prime Minister seemingly benefiting from other issues like Ukraine taking centre stage, there is still a sense of anger and injustice levelled at Boris Johnson and his colleagues who flouted the very rules they created.
I think it matters for ordinary people because many of us were told we couldn't go to a funeral of a loved one, we couldn't go to a wedding, we couldn't go to many things. Close relatives, including parents and loved ones, dying, and they weren't allowed to see them prior to the death. So I think ordinary people feel that there is one law for them and in regards to the lockdown over coronavirus, and one law for other people at the top in Downing Street who could get away with having parties, could get away with breaking the restrictions which the rest of us had to put up with.
The Met says investigations continue with the prospects of more fines being issued. Amina Taylor, London.
Shocking statistics released by a Muslim charity last Friday revealed that a staggering half of all Muslim households in Britain will not have enough money to feed their families when breaking their fast this Ramadan. Islamic Relief estimated that half of all British Muslim households are living in poverty. That's 1.6 million people compared to the 18% of the population in general.
The UK is going through a major financial crisis, with the COVID pandemic and the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine pitted as the two main contributors towards skyrocketing inflation and a lack of fuel supply.
As poverty spreads, food banks come under increasing pressure to deliver. London-based Sufra explained their concerns for the situation.
Muslim families in the borough are particularly affected, especially due to the housing benefit cap, for example, which disproportionately affects families that have more than two children, which, you know, applies to a lot of Muslim families. And so There are families that are living in inappropriate accommodation and not accessing the benefits that they should be entitled to because of these unfair policies. All we're doing is seeing numbers rising. We're hearing firsthand from guests how worried they are, especially now that we're in April, we're in this new financial year, and the guests that are coming through the door are extremely worried about the energy bills that are going to hit them this month.
During Ramadan, Muslims who can afford it make a religious donation to help others less well off, called zakat. With the economy wavering, more will be forced to rely on this generosity of strangers just to survive. Robert Carter, London.
Hundreds of South Korean farmers and fishers protested in the country's financial and political center, Yoido, demanding the government reconsider its intention to enter into yet another free trade agreement. The Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, will follow in the footsteps of previous rounds of deals. The critics argue usher in cheap foreign goods and jeopardize domestic producers.
In the past, during the Uruguay round, the government made fun of the farmers once. And then, during the South Korea-US and South Korea-China FTAs, they deceived our farmers a second time. With the indoctrination of the CPTPP, we are about to be deceived a third time. Should we be deceived?
The 11-member CPTPP includes Vietnam, Australia, Japan, Canada, and Mexico. South Korea only a month ago joined a 15-member trade bloc led by China, as Seoul moves to open 90% of the country's agricultural market. Farmers and fishers demand consultation.
When the government tries to introduce this type of thing, it has to have some policies prepared. Discussing with farmers to some extent, and there should be some hope for agriculture and rural areas. But I don't think it should be pushed unilaterally like this.
Proponents say South Korea's high-tech export-led model needs all the help it can get, with the CPTPP deal set to boost the country's GDP by one-third of 1%. South Korea's own Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy recognizes the negative impact such free trade deals have on those gathered here outside the country's National Assembly. With a corporate-friendly conservative president set to take office here in May, these farmers' concerns over their livelihoods will only grow. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Exactly 1 week before the first round of the French election, the embodiment of the past 5 years marched in Paris. Yellow vests who were crippled, blinded, and mutilated by police. On every Saturday from November 2018 until June 2019, a national bloodletting took place on a scope which was unprecedented in recent Western history. The numbers are as staggering as the lack of Western condemnation for the French government. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 imprisoned, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. Those who suffer the most say they don't want to be forgotten when voters go to the ballot box.
When you're mutilated by the police, there's naturally a lot of suffering and a lot of complications to our daily lives. But we keep our head held up high to show what Mr. Macron has done to his own people.
The huge phalanx of armed police, which still accompany the yellow vests every Saturday, kept their distance, while the mainstream media was not present at the protest almost at all.
It is the average citizens who supports us, because we do not even exist to the state or to the justice system. Where there is no police brutality and there are no victims, then how can we exist?
Over 75% of cases involving hurt protesters are immediately dropped without any court case or even an investigation. Punishment of police for mistreating yellow vest anti-government protesters has been almost non-existent.
By denying that there was any police brutality, the government legitimized it. How can we have confidence in a government which cripples its own citizens or in institutions which do not intervene to stop that? It is truly barbaric violence which chose to mutilate people simply because they believe in a better future.
The yellow vests are routinely credited with an approval rating of 75%, an unheard-of score in a country where perceptions of political corruption are commonplace. The state-sponsored police brutality, combined with the so-called anti-yellow vest laws, scared many into no longer attending public protests. President Emmanuel Macron is expected to win a close re-election, but the damage to France's international reputation cannot be estimated. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the sun sets, this divine voice calls for prayer. But during the fasting month of Ramadan, it also means that the fasting hours are over and Muslims can eat iftar or the breakfast. In Iran, the Ramadan crescent was sighted on the eve of Sunday. So Sunday was announced as the first day of the holy month.
Ramadan is not just about abstention from eating and drinking. It's a time to purify your soul and contemplate on your mission as a human being. It's an occasion to pray and get closer to God.
This holy month is a perfect time to be the best version of ourselves. We take part in charity works and try to be kind to people around us. It is a month of God, and it is so beautiful.
This is the third year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. But this year, COVID restrictions are eased, as the pandemic has partly subsided.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that Muslims mark Ramadan without serious worries over the coronavirus. With the majority being vaccinated, the holy month will once again see Muslims getting together for mass religious ceremonies and prayers.
Taking part in congregational prayers is one of the rituals Muslims do before iftar. Last year, such ceremonies were largely curtailed due to the pandemic. This was also the case for the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights of Ramadan, known as the Nights of Glory, when Muslims congregated mosques to pray and make wishes.
This year, we will host worshippers for the Nights of Glory. During the past 2 years, praying ceremonies were either cancelled or held with social distancing and with a limited participation to curb the pandemic.
Last year and the year before, I caught the virus and couldn't fast the entire month of Ramadan. But thank God, this year everyone is vaccinated and we can observe the holy month together.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar. Based on this calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. The holy month will end with a major festivity called Eid al-Fitr, or the festival of breaking the fast. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped. And the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing 2 Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of 5 Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Ya'bet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the 2 youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by 3 lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A 3rd Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Once NSO Group's Pegasus spyware is successfully deployed against a user, it can hack any phone, intercept messages and emails, view a user's photographs and location, and turn the mobile into a remote listening device, allowing an NSO customer to listen in on conversation held in proximity to the phone. We have prepared for you an article written by Stephanie Kirchgassner. The piece is titled Victim's iPhone Hacked by Pegasus Spyware Weeks After Apple Sued NSO. New evidence has revealed that an Apple iPhone was successfully hacked by a government user of NSO Group's Pegasus spyware in December, weeks after the technology giant sued the Israeli company in a US court of law and called for it to be banned from harming individuals using Apple products. A report published on Tuesday, 5th of April, by security researchers at Frontline Defenders and Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto found that phones belonging to four Jordanian human rights defenders, lawyers and journalists were hacked by government clients of NSO, which appear to be Jordanian government agencies, from August of 2019 to December of 2021. The news appears to show that Apple users could still be vulnerable to surveillance by NSO government clients, even after the company sued NSO last November. At the time, Apple said it was filing lawsuit against NSO and its parent company to hold them accountable for the surveillance and targeting of Apple users. It followed the identification of an exploit by Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto that allowed users of NSO to infect iPhones with the company's Pegasus spyware through a vulnerability in its iMessage function. Apple said at the time that the vulnerability had been patched. The report by Frontline Defenders and Citizen Lab said, "The fact that the targeting we uncovered happened after the widespread publicity around Apple's lawsuit and notifications to victims is especially remarkable. A firm that respected such concerns would have at least paused operations for government clients that have a widely publicized track record of human rights concerns." Jordan's National Center for Cybersecurity categorically denied the findings of the report. It told the Associated Press, "These allegations are baseless and Jordan has not cooperated with any agents with the aim of spying on citizens' phones or censoring their calls." An NSO spokesperson had no comment on the findings, but said that the monitoring of dissidents, activists, and journalist activists by any client would amount to a severe misuse of its product. Once Pegasus is successfully deployed against the user, it can hack any phone, intercept messages and emails, view a user's photographs and location, and turn the mobile phone into a remote listening device, allowing an NSO customer to listen in on conversation held in proximity to the phone. NSO has said it investigates serious claims of abuse and that it does not know how its government clients use its spyware. It has claimed Pegasus is only meant to be used against serious criminals and terrorists. Apple did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The report by Frontline Defenders and Citizen Lab named three Jordanian citizens whose phones they said were hacked using Pegasus, including a human rights defender named Ahmad Al-Naymat, who is currently in prison for a case related to protests at Al-Salt State Hospital, where lack of oxygen has killed several COVID-19 patients. The researchers found that human rights lawyer Malik Abu Arabi, who represents Al-Naymat and other activists, was hacked at least 21 times between August of 2019 and July of 2021. A third target, Suhair Jaradat, is a human rights defender and journalist focused on women's issues in the media. The researchers found that Jaradat had been sent text messages and WhatsApp messages with links to Pegasus spyware. The researchers said the WhatsApp message impersonated a popular anti-government Twitter user in Jordan. The researchers' findings were peer-reviewed and confirmed by Amnesty International's Security Lab. The latest news comes as NSO appears to be locked in battle with the managers of Berkeley Research Group, a consultancy that took over management of the fund that owns NSO last year. Berkeley Research Group is engaged in litigation in London with the previous owners of the fund and claim new details about its frayed relationship with NSO. A witness statement filed by Finbar O'Connor, the managing director of Berkeley Research Group in New York, said that cooperation from NSO's management has been virtually non-existent since it began managing the fund that owns the Israeli company. Finbar O'Connor also said that the Berkeley Research Group is still not in possession of information sufficient for it to understand historic actions by NSO that resulted in the Biden administration placing NSO on a Commerce Department blacklist. NSO did not respond to questions about Berkeley Research Group's claims. The charges raise questions about corporate oversight of the company's executive managers in the wake of last year's publication of the Pegasus Project, an investigation into NSO by Forbidden Stories, a journalistic collaboration that included The Guardian. The Pegasus Project reported dozens of cases of individuals who were hacked or targeted by NSO's government clients, including journalists, activists, and government officials. In Finbar O'Connor's witness statement, the Berkeley Research Group executive said that he understood that NSO is undertaking efforts to identify potential US-based investors early in 2021, but that the effort had been halted as a result of the Pegasus project, which he said negatively impacted investor interest. NSO did not respond to a request for comment in connection to that claim. The company separately faced a new lawsuit in France by a French-Palestinian human rights defender named Salah Hamouri, who, with the International Federation of Human Rights and the Human Rights League, is suing NSO for violating privacy rights in France. An investigation by Frontline Defenders, published in November, found that the mobile phones of Hamouri, whose Al-Quds residency status has been revoked, and five other Palestinian human rights defenders were hacked using Pegasus, NSO's signature spyware. Frontline Defenders' findings were independently confirmed with high confidence by technical experts at Citizen Lab and Amnesty International Security Lab, the world's leading authorities on such hacks. At the time, an NSO spokesperson said it could not confirm or deny the identity of government customers, but that it does not operate products itself and is not privy to the details of individuals monitored.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners. You are listening to the program The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts, biographies, and the works of the most outstanding Muslim dignitaries all across the nation of Islam, the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding figure who is known as the leader of the Shiites of Nigeria. He was directly affected by the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the late Imam Khomeini, and he converted into the Shia Islam. And in today's world, he is the source of benefit for so many of the Muslim Shia preachers in Africa, especially in Nigeria. He's no one but Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Okay, let's start with you, Sheikh Mahdavi. Give us some information about the early life of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki was born on 5 May 1953. According to lunar calendar, it was 15th of Sha'ban, 1372. He was born in Zaria, Kaduna State, and then he attended the provincial Arabic school in Zaria. The school for Arabic studies, and as it is narrated, he had some meeting with Imam Khomeini before the revolution of Iran, and by the revolution he converted to Shia Islam, and after his conversion and embracing Shia Islam, he initiated a lot of school and the Islamic movement of Nigeria,
right,
which is especially for the Shia Islam or Shia followers in Nigeria. So he initiated more than 300 schools in which he was enabled to nurture and cultivate students, a new generation of Shia people over there. Because we have the followers of Ahlul Bayt all around the African continent. But to know about Shia Islam perfectly well, all imams, all rulings, this is something that compared to other religions or to compare to the followers of other sects like Sunnis and yes. other things, it's really few. But in Nigeria, we have the real version of Shia Islam, meaning that they believe in 12 imams. They are believing in the concept of marja'i taqlid. They have to follow a marja'i taqlid. And all these acquaintances took place through the leadership of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, which we can say, according to the history, it has started from 1979, and it's still continuing, even though there were a lot of attack and there were a lot of suffering, yes. specifically during the last yes. decade.
Okay, we got to, we can say those events which took place in Nigeria, killing so many people, including the sons of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Sure. And is it true that more than 12 million people converted to Shia Islam because of him, Sheikh Zainia?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Before this, I should mention that because I had some discussion with a person that had a meeting with Sheikh Zakzaki, and mm-hmm. he had a travel, a tablighi travel to Zaria in 2013. He was saying that the quotation is from him, that Sheikh Zakzaki went to meet with Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi.
Okay.
And there was some discussion between these two. And then Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, gave a copy of Holy Quran mm-hmm. to Sheikh Zakzaki and told him and addressed him, go and preach Islam in your country with this Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And with the bless and barakah of the Holy Quran, after 20, 30 years, we witnessed the population at least 12 million. Of course, some people, they estimate the number of 20 million Shia followers over there. That is, without any doubt, the biggest number of Shia population in Africa continent.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So, with the blessings of the Holy Quran, this movement started. And the Sheikh Zakzaki, as the head of Islamic movement in Nigeria, is known today. As my brother mentioned, the troops invaded the celebration and gatherings that they were having in the month of Ramadan. They had some demonstration in Quds Day, that is the last Friday of the month of Ramadan in 2014 in Zaria. And this, demonstration was taking place more than 6-7 years in that place. But at that year, the troops attacked the demonstration and killed about 35 people, amongst which are three sons of the Sheikh Zakzaki. Mm-hmm. And, our audiences, they may find the video clip in the internet
yes.
that the Sheikh is reciting Talqin for his own three sons, naming them, and these bodies are laid, in the graves.
Wow.
And he is sitting above the grave and reciting Talqin for his own sons. This is really moving.
Yeah, moving and difficult for a father, that's right.
Yeah. So these 35 were killed,
okay.
and the Sheikh himself, after some months, was imprisoned illegally for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was detained. He and his wife were detained, and he was injured. His eyes were going to be blind, but they were not letting him out of prison to have treatment. And when, after 6 years, they allowed him, they sent him to India. That's of right. course, it was sponsored by some, merchants, Shia merchants, the expenses of the travel. But the security officers, they didn't let him to the hospital that they yes. were supposed to go. They directed them to another hospital. And Sheikh Zakzaki rejected. After 3 days, again, they returned back to Nigeria and to the prison. And recently, after more 6 years imprisonment, illegal imprisonment, a court in Nigeria declared that Sheikh Zakzaki must not be in prison and detainment
anymore. He was freed and exonerated from all the wrong accusations, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, he was acquitted by the end.
By the end, that's right. Okay.
But they are not allowing him even now to quit from Nigeria for having treatment, medical treatment for his disease that he is facing with.
That's right, really a source of benefit. He lost three sons or six sons?
Actually, six sons of Sheikh Zakzaki were killed by Nigerian army. In the history of Nigeria, specifically during the last decade, two very grieving incidents took place, which even our listener can Google it and look it up under the name of 2014 Quds Massacre, 2015 massacre. Both took place in Nigeria.
As one of them brother, was in Muharram and the other one in Quds Day, isn't it?
Yes, the second one. So, as my brother mentioned, in Quds Day massacre, the official numbers that they announced, it was something around 35. But for 2015 massacre, above 375 people.
Wow.
And this is besides the bodies that were buried anonymously without telling their names. Oh. They are saying that equal to this number. So above 700 people were killed. To the extent that we see that all these human rights organizations that barely they may stay inside or they may stay with the side of Shia or people, I mean like oppressed people of the world, they denounced the army of Nigeria and they said that these actions, you have to stop attacking Shia minority in your country. So Sheikh Zakzaki, he lost six of his son, and overall he's got nine children.
Okay.
And for now, he's only left with one son and two daughters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a really sadful incident to the extent that many officials, including Maraje and the politicians, took a very harsh stance by denouncing what Nigerian army and Nigerian government did upon Shia community over there. Even in Iran, President Rouhani, they called for the ambassador of Nigeria in order to denounce the rights of actually the attack against the Shia minority in Nigeria.
That's all right. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called Ibrahim Zakzaki as the most oppressed ones in the world who try to, as a believer or a faithful person who tries to achieve proximity between the religions in a peaceful manner. And this was what Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said about him in the Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran, referring to the incidents which took place in Nigeria and Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Really, sacrificing your family and your, especially family members, for your main cause, which is preaching Islam and Shia Islam in Nigeria, which are backed, I think, by the Saudis' money, isn't it?
Yeah, as Sheikh
himself says that.
He himself is saying that this is the result of Saudi support to the army of Nigeria.
Nigeria, that's all right. Okay.
Because of the enmity that this government has upon the Shia.
Especially Wahhabism,
Yeah, definitely.
Because more than 12 million people converted into Shia Islam, a good community over there, and the Ja'fariya school of thought and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, and for sure the Wahhabis, with their money, with the petrol money, they try their best in order to stop it. They are not successful, of course.
Of course, we should mention that this is not the case that we think that, Sheikh Zakzaki's efforts are all going toward, changing people from Sunni into Shia.
No.
Because his own brother now is a Sunni person.
Yes.
And whenever Sheikh went to visit him, Sheikh Zakzaki was performing his salat behind his
brother.
That he was Sunni. He is Sunni even now.
But being Sunni is different from being a Wahhabi, and being extremist. And this is the way, yet peaceful talks and peaceful dialogues and the conversation. And many of the Sunni brethren have respect for the members of the Ahlul Bayt, for Imam al-Hussein and these ceremonies all around the world.
For sure. Okay. You know, and that's the point that Wahhabis, they don't want people be aware of.
Yes.
That Sunni and Shia, they are not having problem with each other.
Yes.
They are all Muslims. But Wahhabis, they try to, you know, broadcast their Salafi and Takfiri
yes.
beliefs.
Yes.
And they are saying that whoever is not following us is infidel.
Okay.
And we should know that Sheikh established about 300 Islamic schools all over mm-hmm. Nigeria and some countries other than Nigeria.
That's right.
And he established the institution of Ash-Shuhada to follow up the affairs regarding the children of martyrs and the orphans.
Yes.
And he also established the Az-Zahra Charity Institution to serve social services and to give, you know, services to people who are poor and they are in need of medical services or different services that they are in need of.
Okay.
So he was not trying to change beliefs,
yes.
but he was trying to change the, you know, poor situation of the people that they were living at Nigeria, and may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless him and mm-hmm. give barakah to his activities even more.
Inshallah. Yes, the humanitarian, you know, actions
yes.
and the deeds that he did in the Nigeria are really beautiful. So many humanitarian organizations were not successful in achieving such, you know, good results that he did through all these years. By the name of religion, the peaceful dialogues and establishing dialogues between denominations over there, so many people converting and really reviving some of the rituals through the month of Muharram and the holy month of Ramadan in Nigeria on different occasions. And this is really, I think, beautiful. And he made the greatest sacrifice that a person can make, you know. Six of the sons were martyred on this path. He is backed by the Maraja and by the Shiite leaders now all around the world.
I just wanted to mention one point. We have to see in response to this movement mm-hmm. which took place and the embracing Shiism mm-hmm. among Nigerian local mm-hmm. people, in response to this, we see Boko Haram was created by Saudi Arabia.
Oh.
And now, what is the fruit of creation or what is the fruit of creating Boko Haram there? And what was the fruit of having such a large movement
Islamic
of Shiism?
Movement of Nigeria.
So now they are Boko Haram, as you know, yes. in their local language means education is banned or forbidden.
Yes.
So they're against humanism, they're against modernism, everything. And this is all backed by Wahhabism. So wherever they go, we see all filthy fruit of their actually family. When they go to Syria, we see Daesh.
Yes.
And when it goes to Africa, we see the African branch yes. of Daesh, which is called Boko Haram, and they are taking or recruiting people from here and there. And all people, even non-Muslims, witness that
yes.
the fruit of Daesh everywhere is actually violence.
That's
nothing than violence.
And people like Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki are really after peace
yeah.
and making peace over there, but with the language of religion and the teachings of the Shia Islam, which is really beautiful and which is really working over there. May Allah prolong his life and may Allah protect him. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi yes. and Sheikh Ziaynia, for your presence
welcome.
In the program, The Teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstory.com/ Ian Call of Islam page. You can download for free all our previous episodes of the program, The Teacher. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.